Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, all of you, with our special welcome to our guest, the HSR. My time is short, you know, you should know HSRC, the FSC, who else? Yes. We're almost ready to start, but what we're running short of is just our technology. We're trying to put our technology together here. So I don't know if we're ready outside, if we could just take this tea meanwhile, just setting up this technology so that we can start. Is that agreed? I don't want to. I assume that at least so that we, whilst we're taking tea, they can set up this. I am aware that we do have hard copies, but I think it would be more useful if. Also, the slides were played here. So I suggest that we take the honorable members and colleagues. We rather start and then so that we can finish early. But we're not in in some of the province. I hear a joke that President Mandela was traveling with another president from another country. Well, there were different signs that they were making and feeling on which territory they were in. I think the other president's watch was gone, and President Mandela said, "Yeah, now I know where we are now." And we're in Cape Town, it's not like that, I suppose. Well, I think the PowerPoint is ready. I assume that HSRC is also ready. We have welcomed Madam Shisana and the team. And thank you very much for coming. You know, every year, this time, beginning of the year, we always call upon your wisdom to come and assist us. We have some of the best policies, and the issue is always, the challenge is always around implementation. So that's why we always call upon your wisdom to advise us in terms of to reflect on the past, and so that we can see whether what we think that we are set to do will be able to achieve. On those few remarks, I would really like to welcome you and the team, and we are in your hands. Thank you.
Okay. Let me first of all start introducing myself and then the team. My name is Dr. Ole Shisana, and I'm CEO of the Human Sciences Research Council. And we do have offices in Pretoria, Cape Town, Durban, Sweetwater, Port Elizabeth, and Mthatha. So in the event you want to visit us to obtain any information, we're just across the street on Plain Park, you know, building. We have a team here comprised of some of the executives and some of the senior researchers. On my left here is Dr. Miriam Altman, and she is a... on my right, sorry. It's a... it's late in the day. It's Dr. Miriam Altman, and she's the executive director that is responsible for our Center for Poverty, Employment, and Growth. and then she'll be saying something about the area of decent work and sustainable livelihood. And further, there is is Dr. Noluto Diko, and Dr. Noluto Diko is our senior research specialist, and she is in the area of education. She works directly in the program on Center for Education Quality Improvement, and she'll be dealing with our education issues later on. And then next to me is Professor Dimitri Labadorias, who's in charge of knowledge systems, and he'll be dealing with some of the issues on food security and food-related, you know, questions, or nutrition-related questions too. And then further on next to him is Dr. Kwandi Gondlo, who is our Executive Director for Democracy and Governance, and he will be addressing some of the issues on land reform and crime and so forth. And the last person that I'm introducing is Dr. Zwelakhe, and Zwelakhe Chandu. He is a sociologist, recently joined the HSRC. He's with the Center for Service Delivery as a senior research manager. What the team is going to do is to really take 5 minutes and go through that, go through their own sections, and thereafter we'll then take questions and comments, make comments. On that first slide, which I just want to put, maybe the next one, please. Okay. On that slide, I just showed the priorities that you have requested us to address. There are many more other issues that we could have addressed, but given the fact that you have requested us specifically to focus on this, we'll try to do that so that we are able to meet your expectations in terms of discussing and presenting what you really wanted us to do. So we'll start with the one that relates to decent work and sustainable livelihoods. If you could put on the first that slide on that, please.
Thanks for having us today. You know, when one looks at this budget, you know, of course, it's only an adjustment from the previous, you know, from the MTEF, and it was very interesting to see how the priorities were done. Having said that, you know, it becomes music to our ears to hear that jobs, you know, decent work is finally, and sustainable livelihoods is finally seen as a top priority, even if it's just currently sometimes in aspiration. I think that some of the choices that were made were quite good ones. And so in its broadest form, I will raise some concerns, but I think in its broadest form, I think we have we're on quite a good track, if I could say, in terms of what I could see in terms of how some of the choices were made, you know, in a very difficult time. And I thought that, you know, on some levels it may be more helpful to talk about how a budget might link to job creation, because I think that's not always so clear. Even when I've sat down sometimes with Treasury itself to say, what would you say is where jobs get created, they would say, well, in infrastructure or in construction. And it's very hard to make explicit the connection between the budget, which is the most important expression of government's priorities, and this highest priority, which is employment creation. Now, the budget statement spends a lot of time talking about how we need to shift the economy towards, you know, particularly market-based employment, towards more labor-intensive activity. And I think that that kind of wording is really to be welcomed, because for a very long time, there was a view that manufacturing and industry doesn't need to create jobs and won't create jobs for a very long time. And until we start applying our creative juices to be thinking about how to do this differently, we're going to be stuck in where we are. Now, the problem right now is that we still do have very much a resource-based economy, and most of the jobs are created in cyclical industries like construction, retail, and so forth. And the problem is that a lot of minerals exporting economies like South Africa, countries that export you know, gold and platinum and all the kinds of things that we export, usually are like that. In other words, they usually get stuck in a kind of situation where they're selling their minerals and they're creating jobs in low-level services. in these kinds of cyclical, domestically oriented industries, it's typical of most, almost all, minerals economies, unless they are kleptomaniac kinds of countries, in which case you don't even have that. What you have is Nigeria with lots of informal sector. So the critical challenge is for us to be able to shift off that path. Now, in the budget, it's stated that that is what we would like to do, and that is very much welcomed. Having said that, it was very hard to see in the budget how that would be done. In other words, that particular aspect, of course, this was a mini budget. But when we start moving towards the next budget round, I think that that is something that a committee like this would possibly like to be seeing more detail on. So just to take one example, if we want to move on to a different path, we must have more R&D. We have to be leading in innovation. We can't lead on cost. So we have to have products that we're selling that are unique. It's just a statement of fact. But we don't, you know, when you say we don't spend enough on R&D, we know that about 0.9% of GDP, our R&D spending is about 0.9% of GDP. That needs to start going to 2%. Now, there may be a commitment to that, but there isn't a funding commitment to it, nor necessarily the concentration. So we saw the commitment to the SKA, but if you want job creation around innovation, it's going to be a dispersed venture capital. You know, you never quite know where jobs will get created. It's not something that gets created in one place when you have a diverse economy. It's something that gets created in a whole lot of places that you didn't think of. So therefore, you need a dispersed type of R&D spending that enables a lot of actors to crowd in. That's just one example. The other kinds of things, if I can just make the link, the continued infrastructure spending, again, becomes very important. Everyone knows that. It's stated all the time. And the continued commitment to it becomes important. Our work shows that had telecoms and commercial transport been globally competitive, unemployment would have been 25% lower. So we've made that kind of connection simply to show people, not everybody understands that the infrastructure, getting that right, is a critical part of the jobs agenda. We can do EPWP and so on, but if we want to get market-based jobs, you have to be able to get your goods out. Just as an example. Now, the problem there is that there's a lot of debate, and it will get more intense around ESCOM, just as an example, because that's the biggest macroeconomic challenge right now. And the critical problem there is that it's not just money. So there's a lot of emphasis on efficiency in this budget. But we need to see how that's going to happen. It's wonderful to hear it so prominently put forward as an aspiration. There's a new M&E ministry. That's wonderful. When you take the state-owned enterprises and some of the key entities that are delivering the network infrastructure, we need to see much more transparency in how those entities, especially the ones that are going to be getting government funding, such as ESCOM, how they are going to be introducing efficiency improvements, how they're going to be getting down the cost of investment somehow, why they need to pace it the way that they are proposing. We really don't have that kind of information. So that right there becomes a major budget question, because either the price goes sky high or government funds it, or we find a more efficient way of doing the same thing. And the third angle of that, we have very precious little information about and almost no debate, and that needs to start coming out in the public domain. Now, there are many other areas that I'm sure I've used up my time. I wanted to raise one more critical issue to highlight. If we can just go to the skip, another one. Next one. Now, I wanted to... I thought maybe my CEO pressed the button. I wanted to highlight this point, that this issue of youth, which is often just bandied around, it's very hard to know what do you do about the youth. In this period, in the next 4 years, or the next 5 years of government, we must have this as a deep priority area, not just as a statement. Now, it was an important area anyway, but we know that more than 50% of young people who leave school are unemployed before the age of 24. Now I know I did something really wrong. It's coming down from the heavens. Okay. Are we safe? But it's alerted me. This issue is so important, and I think we knew it was important, but as of last year, it's become such a huge challenge from the perspective that, while I can say that more than 50% of youth are unemployed. For black youth, it's a very different story, and I think we all know that. That percentage then goes closer to 65% or more. And you can't have the majority of people who are coming out of school, even with matric, because the unemployment rate of matrics is the same as those who don't actually complete grade 12. You can't have the majority of young people not working. Then there's no peer group or very limited peer group. Then you're really talking about a hope and socialization concern, and you're talking about the future. You know, household formation, family formation, social cohesion, just the attitude to work and so on. Now, this is a huge challenge, and we don't have any big answers, but we are looking at it. Now, there are things in the budget that I thought one might want to look at in respect of this. The first is that while the broad area, I forget the entire name, but recreation, culture, and so on, has expanded with the budget, the provincial grant related to sports and recreation is very small and is growing slowly. Now, while that may not seem like a labor market intervention, when you have very weak social networks, that whole area of sport, music, anything that brings young people together while they're still in school, while you still have them, is going to be, you know, it's important anyway, but in the current context, it's so essential, it can't be underlined more as a labor market intervention, almost like a pre-labor market intervention, so that young people can start developing socialized skills around teamwork and maybe start building national networks. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's some positive grouping as opposed to a negative, you know, antisocial kind of grouping, drugs, crime, anything else, or just staying at home watching TV. The other area is the commitment to further education. We have this problem I'm sure you're aware of, which is a reverse or an inverse pyramid, where we have large numbers of people in higher education, although we'd like to see more, and a small number of people in the skilling area. And that pyramid needs to be reversed. I'm sure this committee probably already knows that. Now, I'm not sure that the budget is reflecting that need. So when I looked at the FET numbers and the skills development areas, it was a third of what I was expecting in terms of the numbers and the targets that have been committed to. Those targets should probably triple to get to what was originally envisaged. So they've set a cumulative target of 350,000. It should be at least triple that by 2014, and that would be in a year. In other words, not a cumulative target. You know, that's the game we play around public works. You know, we reached a million opportunities, but that's a cumulative target. So that's a critical issue one might want to be investigating. I don't have the detailed budget figures, but I think that is something one would want to look at. The third area is the area of public sector employment. We know that we had the OSD and a $12 billion adjustment. The concern there is that the skill intensity of the public of public employment has been rising over the years. There needs to be a layer where young people are employed. The public service in any country plays an incredibly important first employer role. The first employment experience of young people, especially graduates, but even of non-graduates, government plays an incredibly important role in many countries, and it won't in this country for the foreseeable future unless we introduce special programs, for example, looking at job hierarchies to introduce more clerks, just as an example. So you have clerks taking statements, police policing, that sort of thing. So until we've got an explicit strategy, we're going to struggle. So these are some of the themes I thought I would raise under the decent work area. Thank you.
Thanks very much, I think, Dr. Kondo. Next slide, please.
Okay, so we'll just quickly do rural development.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we just back up a bit?
Mm-hmm.
This will be a shorter presentation. One more, please. Okay. Now, like the job creation area, it's very welcome that rural development is getting more attention. I think we know that the rural areas have really been really degraded in so many ways from a human perspective, water, land, very, very poor services. Now, just to give an indication, if you compare South Africa to almost any other country in the world, whether developed or developing, about 40% of the population in South Africa still lives in the rural areas, but less than 10% are economically active in something to do with agriculture. Now, that isn't just a development choice. because even if you looked at developed countries, 25% of the rural population would still be in agriculture. Just to give you a comparison, now, South Africa is a developing country, we need to remember, and normally that would be closer to 80% of the economically active population in rural areas would be doing something in agriculture-related activities. So I don't know that that's a sign of development. I think it's a sign of lack of support and of degraded resources, and I think we all see that. Anyone who you can see it with your eyeballs. You don't even have to read it. Now, the particular problem, as we also know, is in the former Bantustan, which has been deeply neglected, and it really shows, certainly in the numbers. Next, please. Now, some of the policy implications. While there is a rising allocation, there's a new ministry, and there's been a growing allocation to rural development, and there has been a sort of 2% above inflation commitment to agriculture, forestry, and fishing. The starting point is so low that if we really wanted to do something about rural development, I think we're going to need to see, at least once the capacity gets to be more, much more of a leap, much more of a step change in the kind of investment. And the kind of areas that are needed are areas, again, that I'm sure this committee is aware of, you know, water management, water catchment systems, land management and care, the extension services, all the kinds of usual supports to farmers, the research and development both for commercial and also for home-based production is not an unusual thing to do. We just came back from China, and there are fascinating things that are being done in the rural areas to promote, even if it's going to be self-support sort of mechanisms. There's a lot of support for households to get some kind of security and self-sustenance. And while that may not want to be our long-term future, the fact is that if people are desperate, that's a big step change for them. So we do very little to invest in R&D, in local development. We've got a problem with input costs, as we know, competition in fertilizer, which, as we know, is unacceptable given that half of it is state-owned. And the training colleges needing to be beefed up. All of these things are things that I think we're aware of and we hear about. But when I look at the budget, although you could say that it rises a little bit above inflation, a background just to give a ratio, if you looked at agricultural expenditure per landed household, you would be allocating maybe $3,700 per person per household. That's not the way to calculate it, but it gives you a sense of how small that spending is compared to the kind of deep support that agriculturalists need, relative to industrialists, as an example, because of the cyclical nature and the difficulty of being in farming. Now, one of the difficulties that we have at the HSRC, which I think needs to be addressed, is that there are very, very weak monitoring and evaluation systems in this area, and that is particularly true, firstly, of the budgeting. It's almost impossible to follow the agriculture budgeting to know what's spent, partly because it's a provincial competency. Secondly, in terms of smallholder farming, it's almost impossible to know what's going on. The official statistics don't tell us anything. It's not monitored. We therefore would not know what sort of resources or support anyone's getting and whether it's helping. So that is a very, very urgent issue that needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thanks. Next slide, please.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, one of the consequences of what the Chair said, the poor implementation or inadequate implementation, is the lack of sufficient job creation in the various formats that Miriam indicated. And one result of that is food security, or rather food insecurity. Unemployment is one of the known proximate causes of food insecurity. And if we look at the food insecurity situation in the country, one can say we've got the good, the bad, and the ugly. We've been pretty good in some things. The introduction of social grants reduced the number of hungry children from 20% in 2002 down to 12% in 2007. That's a big achievement. Our policies on reversing or preventing stunting of children has come down from 24% to 21%. in 2005. And essentially, we have a lot to actually be grateful for or be happy about, but unfortunately, the levels remain very high. For instance, according to the data that we have, national data that we have, half of the households in this country don't have enough energy, don't eat enough energy in the form of food, of course, as a result of which they have a very low intake of micronutrients, particularly vitamin A, zinc, iodine, and other micronutrients, folic acid, niacin, and so forth. Now, again, we are fortunate enough to have had food fortification introduced in 2003, which was a major step, a very progressive step. But nevertheless, the food that is fortified only provides 35% of what one needs in a day. So over and above the food fortification, you have to have adequate food to eat in order to make up your requirements in terms of energy and so forth. So there is the data that we have, because the HSSC is now heavily involved in this, indicate that 50 to 80% of households actually cannot afford to have enough food to eat and meet their requirements. I see I must hurry. And the other thing is that the rural areas, it's more expensive to live in a rural area food-wise than in an urban area, by about 6%, 6-7%. The food costs more in the rural areas. And what we must, in relation to the rural areas, the mistake that we must not make is to think that hunger and food insecurity is an issue of rural populations only. It is not. In fact, the biggest challenges are in the so-called urban informal areas in the country, where actually the prevalence of malnutrition is indeed increasing rather than decreasing, which is the pattern across the country. The good things that we have is also the social grants, the introduction of the social grants, and recently the extension of the age to 18, for children of 18, to receive these grants. But despite that, people do not actually have access to these grants for various reasons. And in fact, all 51% of all severely malnourished households or hungry households that qualify for grants don't have access to them. So we do need a policy that we must roll out the grants in a more comprehensive way in terms of implementation. And also we must expand, as Miriam said earlier on, the production of household production of food in its various forms so that we can attain a measure of food diversification which actually makes for better nutrition overall. Now, what does that mean in terms of policy? Well, what does that mean in terms of policy? Clearly, what we are doing is not sufficient. It's partially effective, but it's not sufficient. I mean, we still have 1 out of 4 children, young children in the country, are stunted, and that is an index of, or a good index of socioeconomic status. And then we have problems regarding the budgets, how the budgets are administered. National government gives X amount for nutrition, but you can never trace that down to the province. In other words, the money comes in the province and then it's used in a way that one cannot determine what actually goes to nutrition. And, you know, we live in a world of competing priorities. And I think that is something that needs to be attended to. Also, any future favorable dispensation towards food security, that money must be ring-fenced. And it must be followed through so that we can actually monitor and evaluate what the situation of hunger and food insecurity in the country is, which at the moment we don't. And our greatest challenge in relation to the resources available is that we have to create new tools, with which to measure food insecurity. We have done a study that analyzed all the national surveys, a lot of money, all the national surveys that we have, and we took different components that are indicative of food security. But none of that will tell us exactly what the situation in the country is. In fact, depending what survey you get, the prevalence of food insecurity and hunger ranges from 2% to 55%, depending what parameter you get. So we do not have one or the instruments, it may be one or more, the tools in any case, to actually determine food security and come out on an annual basis or biannual basis to say, this is the trend in the country, this is the national trend in the country, we are doing better, or identify gaps and needs that we need to go further. There are quite a few more details in the slides that are in front of you, which I haven't had the time to cover, but I believe I gave you the cardinal points to bear in mind regarding food insecurity. And my final point is, please do remember, it's expensive to be poor, and it's more expensive to be hungry in various ways. It's expensive to be poor, and it's more expensive to be hungry, and there are data to show that.
Okay, the next slide, we're just going to look at the question of health, basically looking at the next slide on the 10-point plan that the Department of Health has adopted and which is indicated very clearly in the medium-term budget policy statement as something that the department is going to be focusing on. Next slide, please. In that slide, you can see that it's really a mixture of a number of things, starting with the question of the Department of Health wanting to give a bit more leadership in terms of creating a social compact for better health, you know, with the population. In other words, the minister is saying that he would like to ensure that there is coordination between the national, the provincial, and the district level in terms of service delivery in such a way that the outcome should be better. And we hope that is going to be happening because you all know how the Constitution has set up the relationship between the provinces and national. We are sort of seeing a fiscal federalism, which is also appearing in the budget insofar as certain funds being ring-fenced to the provinces, certain funds, you know, being given directly to the provinces, and the provinces have got the right to be able to shift those resources depending on what they need to do. And I think this is something that Parliament needs to look at because it is at the core of some of the difficulties of service delivery. The also department is aiming to deal with the question of national health insurance, which I'll come to later on, and then also deal with the serious problem of the quality of health services. The quality of health services in the country have been a subject of debate and discussion in many of the public fora. Unfortunately, the argument seems to be saying that everything is very bad in the public sector and everything is good in the public sector. That is not necessarily the case. There are facilities that are really good in the public sector that provide a very good public function. And in fact, in a research that has been done by the University of Cape Town, they've been able to determine that the differences in quality of services between the public and private sector are not too far apart, as seen by the people who are receiving the services. However, where there are problems, funds have to be made available, and I'm not convinced that the budget that has been given here is sufficient enough to be able to address the quality of health services, to improve the quality of health services. If you look at it, it's indicated there's public-private sector partnerships on this and that small little things, but not a very comprehensive approach where a whole number of facilities would actually be improved to be able to deliver the services. And then, of course, there is the big problem of human resource, and here there's a big shortage in terms of some of the doctors in the country and some of the nurses. Some of them are leaving the country and going outside. So the amount of money that has been allocated here in terms of the occupational dispensation, OSD, as well as the question of increase in salaries, I think it's welcome because it is probably going to be able to keep some of those health workers in the public sector instead of going to the private sector or going outside the country. It will also help to attract them to not to go into other professions but go into the professions in which they were trained to do. So I think that's a very good one. And then the overhauling of the entire healthcare system and improving management, you know, there needs to be more resources that actually go into this, because if you don't have a good manager in the public health sector or in any facility, everything else is not going to go right. There's not going to be the efficiency that you'd like to be able to see. Now, I would like to come to the next slide rather than to go deeper onto there. Just to give you one example of that 10-point plan that we saw is the question of dealing with the question of HIV/AIDS. HIV/AIDS is a big problem for this country. We continue to lead the world in terms of the number of people who are infected with HIV. The good thing, though, is that we're beginning to see a decrease in new infections among teenagers, which is really, really good. It means that the programs that have been implemented are beginning to make an impact. And we can confidently say that the condom use rate in the country is decreasing. I mean, it's increasing substantially, particularly among young people, but also with the, you know, older people, which means that people are taking protective measures to ensure that they can prevent themselves from becoming infected with HIV. In fact, some of the work that we're doing in the HSRC now is beginning to show that overall we're beginning to see a decrease in new infections, you know, in South Africa. And I think that is really good. Therefore, the budget that has been allocated for 4.4 billion rand, you know, for 2009 and 2010, going into the HIV/AIDS program is welcome, but obviously it may not be enough simply because of the fact that we still have such a huge load of people who are infected with HIV. The 900,000 people that are expected to be receiving ARVs by 2011 to 2012, we would argue from the HSRC that, you know, they probably will reach that number far earlier, because on the basis of the study that we've just done, we found that 800,000 people in South Africa are actually on antiretroviral therapy. And we're able to determine that, obviously, from the blood samples that we received. We tested them to be able to see what proportion of those actually have any signs of traces of any of the ARV drugs. The next slide quickly just shows that there's been a terrible underspending, I mean, underinvestment in health. Treasury has not given health as much money as they should have given. No wonder why we've got so many problems with the quality of health services. If you look at that slide, you can see that from 1999, that blue line at the bottom, health was given a very small amount of money per capita. You look at it, it's about, it was 1,000, and in 2000, you know, the base year being 2000, if you look at it, and you come to about 2006, you see we're getting to back to the same place where we were in 1996. Now, the increase that they've given now in the budget, which is about 8.6%, I would argue that it's not enough given the underspending, underinvestment that has happened over a long period of time. I would argue that the budget for health should have actually been much higher than what we're seeing. If you compare that to that, the green line there in the private sector, look at how the private sector has been spending in terms of healthcare, and it's spending to serve very few people. The public sector is invested to deliver services to 85% of the population. So that is what needs to be corrected, and I hope this committee has got the power to be able to change the budget and make sure that health actually does get a bit more money. The next slide is on national health insurance. One of the 10-point plans, 10-point plan activity that is listed is the question of introducing national health insurance, which aims to have universal access to health care that is free at the point of service, that is paid from the general tax as well as the dedicated tax that is publicly administered, and that is provided by both the public and the private sector. Now, the UCT did a study on this to see whether South Africans actually support, you know, this type of policy, and it's clear that there is very good support. I mean, you can see on the study when they did a population-based survey and they asked the population, would you agree to pay a small amount each month so that if I get sick, healthcare will be free, even if I'm not sick now? 76% of the population says yes, they would do that. What was interesting is that there would even be a 71% of those people who are currently on Medicare scheme saying that yes, they'll be prepared, you know, to actually contribute to NHI. So what we see is that here the government has got a policy. They've included it in the 10-point plan. It has public support. There may be a few people who are unhappy about it, but the overall majority of South Africans, on the basis of scientific evidence, are actually supportive of that. The next slide, I just want to deal with the final issue on the research and development. In order for us to know whether the health of South Africans is improving, even whether under NHI or under even the current conditions, we in South Africa, according to the Department of Health, is to introduce a National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey under the research and development point under the 10-point plan. That particular program would be a very good one in terms of giving information about the health status of the population and the nutritional status of the population, following clearly what you have already indicated. So for that reason, we would think that there has to be an increase in the budget of health to be able to introduce that, so that you can be able to monitor the health status of the population. That kind of program, if introduced, would help you a lot in terms of being able to determine as to whether are you getting money, value for money. Are you simply giving this money to the Department of Health and then being able to determine as to whether, you know, you are making progress or not progress in terms of the health outcomes. People will be, you'll be able to know what proportion of the population has got diabetes, what proportion of the population is actually on medication, what proportion of the population is on HIV, what proportion of the population has got a heart condition, and so forth and so forth. And we hope that you'll be able to support a budget for health. Really, we do believe that from the information that we have, we need to have more resources for the health budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to members of the House. I want to speak, you know, just generally on the area of service delivery and along the same, you know, sort of points and lines that the previous speakers have. As we all know, there are challenges around this area, you know, generally service delivery, regardless of the sphere of government one is looking at. Obviously, the issues, you know, sort of change as you look at its particular sphere. For example, when you look at local government, you know, there's issues around access to, you know, sort of basic services. And then when you look at the public service, it's more sort of issues around, you know, service quality and so on. And a lot of surveys that have been done generally indicate that the levels of trust and, you know, sort of confidence that people have in government, you know, is generally, you know, basically low, you know, given these, you know, scenarios. And also, I think even the medium-term budget statement did make reference to public services not generally meeting, you know, sort of the legitimate expectations, you know, of the citizens in terms of what they're entitled to, what they should be getting, you know, sort of, and so on. So there's issues around, you know, access, but also issues around the where there is access, the quality, you know, sort of basically of that access. Next slide. Yes. We have, even though we've concentrated mainly, you know, sort of on local government, what we've found as well is that generally there's, you know, issues around, you know, intergovernmental, you know, sort of relations. For example, if you look, obviously a lot of the protests around, you know, local government, you know, given its proximity to people, it being the closest sphere, you know, that there is to, that is closest to people. But at the same time, though, some of the areas, you know, of underperformance have a lot to do with linkages with, you know, sort of other spheres of, you know, sort of government. Because some of the services over which there's protest, for example, do not necessarily reside with local government in terms of provision. It's usually maybe state-owned enterprises in the case of electricity or, you know, basically, you know, sort of other areas. So the point being that, you know, all of these spheres are basically links in a chain and, you know, basically need to be looked at, you know, sort of in that manner insofar as, you know, unraveling, you know, where their stress points are and what basically needs to be addressed, you know, from a corrective, you know, sort of standpoint. Other issues have a lot to do with, lack of, you know, participatory mechanisms, you know, the distance or the disconnection, you know, between, you know, sort of structures and, you know, basically people on the ground, and that having significant implications around, you know, accountability and, you know, you know, services and structures being seen as working in the interest, you know, sort of people, you know, so and so on. We've also, there's also other issues around, if we can get the next slide maybe. There's also several other issues that are also, you know, quite, you know, sort of, you know, render or worsen the situation around, you know, delivery. In terms of, you know, lack of professional systems, which then impact, you know, on their ability to retain people, high turnover rates and so on, lack of support between the different spheres, provinces and national departments supporting, you know, sort of local governments and so on. You know, different systems, you know, for different departments, different municipalities, because the different municipalities are sort of differentially resourced and expected to run with, you know, mandates when in fact they've got, you know, variable, you know, abilities in terms of, you know, meeting all of those, you know, sort of needs, priorities, you know, basically mandates. And then we could just have the last slide. And just some of the issues, you know, that, you know, going forward would be quite important, you know, sort of to, you know, to, for us to focus, you know, our attention on. The whole issue basically of, you know, review around the structures, you know, that pertain, you know, sort of on the ground, how they function, their effectiveness, you know, and so on in terms of, you know, the ability to, you know, basically meet needs around, you know, accountability. Good governance in terms of financial, you know, sort of performance management, you know, sort of and so on. But also the whole idea of looking at, you know, comparative experiences in terms of how they've, you know, dealt with issues of local government. But not only that, but to answer the question fundamentally of do we need to prevent the system and, you know, correct some aspects of it, or do we actually need, you know, basically a new, you know, sort of model altogether that will basically achieve, you know, some of the intended objectives, you know, so that, that we, you know, are desirable from the perspective of what government is basically, you know, meant to achieve. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the House. I am just, can you, next slide. I'm just going to briefly talk about land reform, agrarian transformation, and rural development. Fortunately, I'm closely in touch with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. And one is basically aware of the progress made by the department so far. Number one, I think one is particularly impressed by the conceptual and strategic framework the department has developed, the Comprehensive Rural Development Program, which was developed in June this year. Basically, the document outlines the mandate of the department and the three-pronged strategy for Comprehensive Rural Development Program, and it includes a number of issues, including critically amongst them agrarian transformation, rural development, and land reform. And most importantly, out of this document has come a report on the Guyana pilot of Comprehensive Rural Development Program. And the report I'm still very keen to see is the pilot in Umhlanga Municipality, the rural development pilot in Umhlanga Municipality by the Eastern Cape Provincial Government. These documents are very clear, quite elaborate, because the strategy document, for instance, goes to the extent of separating what can be achieved in the short term, medium term, long term. And my assessment of it is a very well thought through, thorough document that has been produced by the department so far. But I think I have a few issues I would like to caution members of the House about, especially to support this particular department. And I'm also looking at the budget allocation, if one reads the medium-term budget speech. I'm inclined to agree with my colleague, Dr. Altman. I actually think the budget it's a bit constraining if one looks at the amount of work that needs to be done by this particular department. You see, the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs, it's a service delivery department. And unfortunately, that department cannot succeed to deliver what it has to deliver if local government is not sorted out. That is the key issue. I think that needs to be looked into because the Democracy and Governance Program at HSRC in conjunction with PLUS at the University of Western Cape, the Program for Land and Agrarian Studies, we started the process just to evaluate what has been done by the former Department of Land Affairs, looking at specific projects in Limpopo, the 18 LROD projects that were the first ones to be studied by the Department of Land Affairs. Only two of those projects are actually surviving at the moment. Others are collapsing. People are selling land back to the white owners. So for this department really to start fixing the mess, which is an existing project, is going to be time-consuming and resource-consuming. Besides fixing the mess, I think one of the problems with the delivery of land reform and rural development is that the intergovernmental relations framework needs to be strengthened at the level of implementation. Like I said, with rural development and land reform, you cannot deliver if, number one, your local government sphere is sort of messy, and if your provincial administration does not provide clear and well-defined support to municipalities. And I think we are likely, unless we address these issues, to run in circles again with land reform and rural development in the next coming 3 years. So I think these are the issues which we may need to look into. Okay, I will not get to the details of the whole presentation. I'll move to the second area that we are looking into. This is the fight against crime. Here as well, our view as the program at the HSRC is that very good work is being done, and it's done within the context of the National Crime Prevention Strategy. But what we see is a weakness at this particular stage, but it's something that can be attended to, is that in the implementation of the National Crime Prevention Strategy, the emphasis has been on deterrence through the use of force and the criminal justice system, and less emphasis on other three pillars identified in the National Crime Prevention Strategy, especially working with communities, raising awareness amongst communities. We actually think this is one of the issues that may need to be looked into. We're also working with the Department of Community Safety in the Western Cape to pilot a community safety barometer in order to track perceptions at community level of safety over time. And in this way, the effectiveness of intervention to fight and combat crime can be assessed. Next slide, please. Oh, okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, could we then get input on education? And I believe you have the presentation here. It's not actually on the screen, but you have it.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Now, what I've done is to list the key priority areas that the government has identified, and I will speak to those. We are extremely excited about these priorities at the HSRC, but we also want to know that the country has true national as well as international benchmarks shown that our academic achievement is actually less than remarkable. And we are also acknowledging the fact that the government realizes that, hence the call to basics in education. For example, one of the key areas that the government wants to focus on is that teachers, learners, and parents have to work together in order to turn our schools into centers of excellence. But it would be extremely helpful to explain what the government means by these centers of excellence. What is it that the government expects the schools to do that the schools are not doing currently? That would definitely improve things quite a lot, because as it is right now, it's very, very, it's up in the air. It's anybody's game. And then the next point is that there is a need to improve school management. Formal training will be a precondition for promoting teachers to become principals or heads of departments. Obviously, this is a point that will definitely enhance the aim of making schools thriving centers of excellence. However, a study that we conducted, for instance, last year at the HSRC in four provinces has shown that there are, for instance, structures in place that are aimed at improving governance in schools. However, those are not being fully exploited, and we are scared that this might still lead to the same. So it would, again, in terms of the policy, be very, very helpful. And also in terms of our budget, if we could know exactly how much is going to be used towards this. Because one of the main complaints that the teachers had was that they do not even know, for instance, particularly those who are in the positions of being lead teachers, they do not even know, for instance, what criteria is used in order to promote them. So the government needs to be more clear on this to give guidance so as to make sure that this can be fully implemented at the school level. The government's report of 2009, Trends in Education Macro Indicators, is showing that there has been an increase, actually, in ECD provision. And the government is also in these priorities explicating that the intention is to make sure that access to grade R by 2010 is doubled and the number of 0 to 4 year old children is doubled by 2014. Sorry, by 2010 there has to be universal access, and then by 2014 the number of 0 to 4 year old children in ECD programs is a doubled. This is one of the problems that is cited, for example, by teachers as to why the quality of our education is not improving. They are complaining that they are getting learners who are coming from the lower grade without being fully prepared. And if our ECD programs could take care of this, this would actually be much better and with time be eradicated. This, therefore, leads us to the issue of equity. Now, how do we make sure that the areas where we don't have proper ECD programs, we get these in place? This is something that needs to be explained by the government. Teachers ought to be in class on time, teaching with no neglect of duty and abuse of children. We have seen quite a number of these road shows where we get to hear what is expected and we get to see our officials going to schools. It would also be very, very helpful, particularly for those who are implementing the policy, if the data, for instance, that is collected as these officials are going around is made available to them. So that by them, we mean the teachers, so that they know exactly the areas where they need to be improving on. For instance, we have seen ministers, we have also seen even the president talking to principals of schools. But the information that they gather through these road shows should also be filtered through into this, because this is part of the strategy to improve our education. One of the areas at the moment that seems to be troublesome is the area of secondary education. It's either our learners drop out and they don't survive through to the end, or they do not participate as much as they do in the lower grades. Now, again, the question is, what ways and strategies, for instance, can we put in place to make sure that they not only survive in secondary education, but also they go through to higher education, which again has been prioritized by the government. So for us, the issue here is we do see the call for going back to the basics of education, making sure that there are teachers in classes, they are in school on time, and that there's cooperation between school parents and learners, as well as the government. However, we need to have clear indicators of those, because we had the policies in place that speak to that. However, implementation has been the one area where there has been lack. One point that is coming through very, very clearly, which unfortunately is becoming very, very troublesome. We have a study at the HSRC that is currently being undertaken on the issue of violence and sexual harassment in public schools. This is becoming quite troublesome, particularly in areas like the Western Cape and Gauteng. We have actually even seen, I think this past week, in the Northwest Province, a case, again, similar to this one, but it was not violence on learners, but it was violence officials. Now, how do we ensure that this does not happen again? How do we ensure that the collective that is working to make sure that this is eradicated puts these together into research that is accessible to the public and even to the teachers in schools? And then lastly, I want to just quickly go to the issue of FET, further education and training. We have quite a lot of campuses and colleges that are geared towards this. But the problem, again, is how do we ensure that these colleges are properly utilized? Because as it is at the moment, they do not enjoy the same kind of prominence as our universities do. So these are issues that the government needs to look into as we see them at the HSRC. Thank you.
Chairperson, we have completed our presentation and we are ready for questions or comments.
Thank you very much, Madam Shisana and the team for the comprehensive input. I'm sure members are just worried about the time. I think it's correct to say we can't do justice, and I think that this input really touched the bone of what you call the whole MTBPS. MTBPS is about. Now, you know, last year, every time we meet, we always worry that we're not meeting often, we're not getting often in touch with you, you know, so that rather than conflating all these, what they call, important inputs, you can come here, say, with Dr. Digo, and we deal with education, and we focus on education. It's a whole lot of area itself, and each one of the topics that you have covered. Now, members will advise, but I think that as well, in fact, that's why we also allowed you to kind of take more time than we had expected, you know. but because the areas that, the presentation were really very good presentations. We still have our friends from the FFC. But be that as it may, maybe let's engage. The time is 25 past 6. And it will be unfortunate that the presentation has taken an hour, and we'll have less time to engage. Mama Ngabo, Sarah Blom.
I am suggesting that the HSRC takes our questions and then give us written responses, because if they were to respond to the plethora of questions that we have, it might not be possible to get the other team. Thanks.
Comrade Harald Baum.
Chairperson, thank you. Only my question, I would love to discuss the rural development, because that's very close to my heart.
We'll come back to the suggestion you're making, but my suggestion is that
we can't just give them a blank check and say thank you very much for coming, these are our questions, and go. Let's engage them a bit. Questions will not be responded to, all of them, I suppose, but we need some engagement with them. I mean, there are things that we really need to find clarity on. Yeah.
Now we'll come back to the one of education. My question is, did they have also hear from the teachers by themselves what is the problem they experience? Because information that I have is that the reason why many of the teachers just say enough is enough is that 40 to 50% of the time they are busy with administration. Now, if you look at the schools in China and in other parts in the East, then you will immediately see that when you have a teacher for maths, he comes in the class and he's there for maths, he's there for science. He's nothing to do with administration. Now, my question is, at the end of the day, is there not too many red tape at this time for the teachers? I just want to put that question. And what is the reason how many teachers just say enough is enough? That's not part of the problem we experience. And my second question is, mother tongue. Is there also not a big problem that many of the children didn't get training or education in their mother tongue? I can express myself better in my own language, and that is why I'm here asking what is the position with mother tongue language. That also not part of the problem we experience. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks. On education, FET College is well resourced comprehensively. Should I ask all the questions I have? And then on grants. What do you mean by a rollout of grants in a more comprehensive way? what is happening now, is it not comprehensive? How comprehensive or more comprehensive can it be? Lenny also spoke about nutrition allocation, and you said something about provinces. Are there any problems in provinces? What are the problems that you have seen in your various studies? Health-wise, and what are the tools that can be used to measure food security? I think health-wise, I was well covered, but if the budget for health is inadequate, do you mean that it's inadequate 100% because there's revitalization, there is ARVs, there is those many things, or all the programs are underfunded? Protests are said to be urban. In rural areas, you haven't come across people who have got protests, or maybe in their instance, they've got no way of raising that protest because they are rural. Have you looked at that one? Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presenter. I'm just following up on the issue of food security, because we had those many, many programs, that support programs. Which ones were more effective and benefited the people? And in health, I really feel we need to do something. I have no question there. And then with service delivery, we have this problem with MIC, and we also have provincial. I usually don't like to pronounce it as PIC, because if we could have all these infrastructure grants, because most of them are directed at local government, have you ever thought of maybe having them in one pot where local government could be accountable? And what do you think are the constraints where local government has to wait so much? We know they have other sources of revenue where they can maybe do a little bit of infrastructure, but you always find them blaming the upper spheres, where if maybe we had them in one pot and maybe treasury is accountable or someone is accountable for this, wouldn't it be more effective? And my other one is, how far is this, it goes to education, ECD, is it now under one department, because it had to do with social development and education, and how, because there's somewhere where the facilities were established by social development, training is somewhere, and this connection had some effect on the maybe universal access, and the fact that by 2014 we'll have reached the target that was mentioned by the presenter. And the last one is, how far is the alignment of our education and the economy of South Africa, the subject you offer, and as related to what they need to do after training? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Comrade Mashego. But I would like FSC just to note some of the questions that you think that are relevant to yourself, you know. But I suspect that some of the questions might be relevant to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I start with the just a question on the education. But first, maybe let me just say that the input were very good, actually. Much as they've taken a lot of time, I find them quite refreshing. It's just that we don't have enough time. But on the education part, if I may ask a question, the medium-term budget statement has a lot of suggestions they make around the issue of education, which is linked to also employment creation and ideas and options that are suggested in it, including the voucher system and all that. I know that perhaps is a new area that you may have not studied beforehand, but I would like just to get a comment around that, whether that 10-point plan or the plan in terms of including that voucher system, will it cushion the problem that we have if the comments that you normally get about the children that start school from primary when they get to matric, you would have lost about 65% have dropped out. What is your suggestion in terms of remedy of that kind of problem? Is it a problem in terms of the policy? Or what is then what has to be done in terms of addressing that particular problem in particular? Because I think that because when you speak about a budget and you speak about the injection of money into it, does it actually fix that particular kind of structural problem and quality problem? So that's a really first question that I just want to understand from the education. The doctor here spoke about land reform. If I could just with the first question around, it's quite useful to hear the issue about crime prevention, national crime prevention strategy, the implementation, the pillars of it, in terms of which one is not being implemented. But in terms of the actual study that you have in terms of looking at it, particularly on the emphasis on the one part of it, my little interaction before with the police, there's always been this reluctancy on general implementation that includes the partnership. There's always been doing the police the way we always used to do it. And that's emphasis on the one leg that you've just spoken to. So it strikes me to say that there's an implementation, whether it's maybe your comment on that. Now, this is a more general question that I would also want the doctor to speak to. In terms of the budget discussion about not sufficient budget being put into, and I've heard you speaking that you want to speak to the first, Miriam, when you spoke about the Treasury, that when you speak to them, sometimes you don't quite understand each other when they have explained certain things. But my question is different. Treasury in the South African government, as what maybe we still have to deal with, it wields lots of power. Sometimes to a power of dictating type of policy which dictate the allocation of budget. So in order to fix the problem, we've got to go in intervention at the heart of the problem. So my question is, in discussing the issue of the budget, at the engagement or conceptual of budget area earlier in the process, is there an engagement with yourself, with Treasury, in order to help understand the issue of the direction, including the budget? Because otherwise it becomes additions to what has been given at the budget in the previous year in terms of percentage, rather than intervention or program. So that's really a question that is more general. It's quite interesting, this issue about the local government, the land reform, and what will work and what will not work. Maybe it will be useful when we have time just to engage a little bit about the budget vis-a-vis the strategic plan of the department. That kind of intervention is quite worrying, this issue about the land issues and the reselling of the land, because then what it means is that whole program that has been driven just basically falling its head. So we reverse back, whether it's 1% of land reform, it slides back into a comma, point zero something. So the intervention, what type of intervention in terms of this policy that begins to address a sustainable that reform process? So maybe if you have that in a document, so we could easily read and look at it. The just quick on health, Doctor, it will be perhaps useful at some point to read a little bit the narratives of the National Health Plan. But it was interesting to hear your comment around, maybe we have to have a session that discusses that issue so that we get a detail, not one point of a kind of a research that we don't have the narratives of it. My issue is, what will it do if we were to put injection, the resource injection, in the current system, that's the budget issue, in order to fix the health system, to make it the public have the basic health access to work, before you even look at the higher end of it? What will it take in terms of budget? What is it, the budget, if you want to fix that in terms of long term? So I would like just to hear you, Doctor, out on that issue. I think in the interest of time, I had a few more on this issue about public sector, but perhaps other will come back, maybe.
Put all the questions, we will make a suggestion, you know. We just put at the back of our minds the initial suggestion, what we're going to do about it.
Okay.
Just throw everything.
Okay. Just to maybe... Part of this, Prof, about the food security. The food security and the government program has been driven for particular results. You come to us and you present and you say, in terms of your presentation, between 50% and 80%. If I got you correctly, in the poverty diagram line in terms of affordability of food. And you say that in terms of the fortified food, 35% of people only address 35%. So we probably have the challenge that you haven't addressed in your input, maybe because of time, of what is to be done around that issue. Because if that stats is correct, moving forward with regard to the budget, there might be an issue of sustainability of actually more people getting poorer, and that can have a catastrophic result. Now, the question of what is to be done in terms of research, including what informs the program, because in a medium-term budget statement, this issue is addressed, this particular issue is addressed in terms of moving forward, even though the minister says you're not dealing with a welfare state, you're having balance. But I think you need to understand from you what is to be done to address that particular challenge. Chair, let me leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ma'am Tim.
No, thanks, sir. Unfortunately, I will have come, but Can I be allowed to use my steward voice because I was once a shop steward? Do you allow me to
take it? Close it.
Oh, okay.
We're recording, ne?
Okay. No, thanks, sir. I am on education. I just wanted to check that since education is a priority of this government, in terms of in terms of the priorities as listed here in this document, the bullet 3 on ECD, which speaks to the universal access to grade R, what I want to check, Chair, is whether HSRC has any recommendations in terms of addressing the universal access to grade R. Precisely, I'm asking this because I want to check whether are you considering, whether the report considers also the contextual factors that are being experienced, I believe, on a daily basis by the institutions down there. For example, we would love maybe to know how do you advise the government or the department in terms of planning to address that, to improve the infrastructures, the issue of training educators for the ECDs, because reality will be speaking to the contextual factors that if we are not addressing, we might not be able to resolve the problem that is at the level of the school before the learner goes to the formal schooling. Because one of honorable members has already indicated that in terms of the ECD currently, you will find that ECD are being integrated, but you don't find up what strategy that begins to involve social development, what strategy that begins to involve municipalities, but you also believe that municipalities will be assisting schools in building some of these informal creches, preschools, and so on. But in terms of the formal integration, whereby curriculum will be the same, so that when schools move from that particular ECD to the formal schooling, there is no curriculum that informs or sort of align whatever that has been formalized by the institution. And also, what one has recognized is that those preschools do not have the capacity in terms of training of the teachers that are there, which also lead to what is being earned by those people that are at the ECDs, which is not the living salary. Now, I'm checking this because I want to check whether, if I'm saying they don't have capacity, I also want to say they are not also sustainable. Whereas there is a problem at the primary schools, because normally what will happen at the primary school, you will find that it's a school whereby grade one is plus minus 200, of course, maybe with six teachers, there will be a split in terms of the classrooms. I'll make an example of one school where they take one classroom from grade one to provide for the grade R. But in terms of capacity, volume of grade one, normally, yearly, the number will be above 200. But how do you ensure that the learners in grade one are all from that grade R class? Because the grade R are only consumed in one classroom. But when they move to grade one, it's six classrooms. Obviously, first come, first serve for the grade R.
Sorry, Mam Tem, I know which because of passion, you know. I don't want you to go details. I want you to cover other questions as well.
Okay.
I think the point has been made. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Chef. I'm sorry for that. But then my question then was going to be, are there any recommendations, actually? I was just giving an example so that you understand what is it that I wanted to refer to. Now, what could be the advices from the HSRC to the government department? And also, how far do you think this MTS will address this particular area? I thank you.
That is Madam Kulisi, but I am busy, Mam Tem. Tatana Mabun, did you have your hand up?
Yes, let me just take one quick thing. Very quickly.
Chair, first let me say or join you when you in your initial saying that will not be doing justice. I think the HSRC has got more information definitely that as a portfolio committee is of vital importance, especially when they also indicate the research that they've made and some recommendations, if one can put it, because there are some other in their slides where they show the criticality and what is supposed to be. However, I think definitely justice will not be done today with us and them. Let me go straight to the question. It should sound very literally and, of course, be provocative in terms of trying to get the information that they do have. For example, I'll start with the question in the health. You know, where is that? Yeah, in health, it has been alluded and strongly said that the Department of Health definitely is underinvested all the time, showing the graph there, which indicated the public and the private sector, the private, you know, budgeting system from 1996 to 2006. One should also ask the question to say, if the department, which is also of the five priorities by our government, is being under given small amount of budget, and then the recommendations sometimes are being said or indicated by yourself, did you ever maybe sometimes get the response, why are you always underfunded? I mean, the department is always underfunded. Or maybe that might be too political, I don't know. But more than that, let me ask another simple question, provocative one also. Public support for national health insurance, in terms of your research, you have got that the figure 76% agreeing to pay a little amount or so, and others so and so and so. Generally, if we look it to say, or generally, the people do understand what is meant by this national health insurance scheme or the system or the program itself. So that should not only the sample should not be looked to capture only for those who understand it by reading and so on and so on, but we talk about also, I think it also covers the layman in the street. And then, Chair, I've got one question. Whether it's in food security, yes. I heard him saying, if he's not here, but it's him, I believe, saying that in food security, food is expensive in rural areas than in urban areas. Just for us to get that, you know, broader information, and coupled with that one of saying it is expensive to be poor and more expensive to be hungry. Those are the information that one should build our argument in terms of when looking into the food security program. Lastly, in the Department of Education, I mean, in the education where it has been said, where is that area again? I've missed my things. Thank you, Chairperson, for not taking my time.
Don't worry, you will, once you find your question, you will come back. Honorable sir.
Yeah, I don't want to question. I was just to start off by saying that it was an excellent presentation. Thank you very much. And unfortunately, every line in all those presentations are virtually loaded. You know, you can ask so many questions about each one of them that really we cannot do justice to this presentation. And I think we should get them back here and let them take two of the areas at a time. I think that'll take them four sessions. And, you know, make it interrelated. And I would really like to propose that we ask them to come back as soon as possible and that we have a look at it, because I've got so many questions. I'll keep them here until 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. Really, I will. Because there is a lot of questions that we want to ask. And, you know, it's such good information that we received this afternoon.
I think that I can agree more with you. But we must find a solution. Ma'am Ngolo, you have a last question?
The last thing, it might be minor. Are you aware of the price per hectare? Because when the department was here, it told us something that was so big.
Price of land.
Price of land, yeah.
Thank you very much. I think that I want to agree with Honorable Swart. However, I think from my side, I've been listening very attentively, you know. But just to make the first remark that I didn't know that there are so many teachers from our own team here. Everybody was just interested in education, you know. that is good. However, I think the trend or seem to be saying that there's not enough funds in order to deal with the challenges that are facing us. The Minister of Finance, when he presented his budget, he says we're going to need 70 billion that SARS has under-collected. Now, there are these needs besides. But also, he went on to say it means that we must do more with the little that we have. Have you perhaps looked at that to say, with the limited resources that are there, what is it that can be achieved? In fact, what he said is that in terms of the budget that was announced by Minister Manuel in April, he's going to continue with that. But it's clear that in going forward, we should not expect much growth in terms of the budget. Then how do you think that the challenges that we face with can be done? They have established also a subcommittee to deal with excesses of government that they need to do away with. With all that, we need to do the things that you're saying, especially in your 10-point plan, Chairperson, of health, all those kind of things. How do we achieve them with this little that we have? We're not expecting to have more. I shouldn't talk about education. Everyone has spoken about education. With rural development, is it reality? But also, I think that perhaps your input here, perhaps in terms of what I want to say, is also saying that it's not necessarily a reality that people who live in rural areas would want to live by agriculture, for instance.
Or is it realistic that people who live in rural areas would necessarily depend on agriculture? I don't know if you have looked at the EPWP. Government, I think at the beginning of the year, put aside 4 billion. On EPWP to create work. I'm not sure if there has been any study in terms of saying, so is there anything that is being done? But they created what they called an incentive scheme for those who can really create a job. I think labor intensive or matter to do it. But I'm not sure that if from the reports that you're picking up that people are succeeding in doing that, whether it's at a province, or local government level. The food security issues, I don't know if you have looked at the annual report, for instance, of the Department of Agriculture. This committee also looks at the quarterly expenditures. And I don't think that as a committee we are convinced that there is sufficient, what you call, spending. There are programs that are meant to assist, programs like your, I just forget the name of the program now, but I will tell you, but it's the program that is meant to ensure that everyone, support is extended. Not Mafisa, CAFS, yes. Our experience is that it is not sufficient, what you call it, expenditure on those programs. We don't know whether the problem is with government not being able to give enough, what you call, attention to it or intake or what, but clearly there is understanding around those programs. And this side, there's a challenge of insufficient food security. I'm not sure as to what is it that can be done. Also, you have spoken about these limitations of support that are there, whether it's food, nutrition, at school, or that. There's other debate on the other hand. Other people are saying, no, what South Africa needs is your basic income grant. Is it something that can be useful? But I think of late I haven't heard much noise from the protagonists of BIC, for instance. The issues of service delivery in local government. You indicating here that there seems to be, and I think that the Minister of Local Government also was saying the same thing at the National Assembly yesterday, that there seems to be a social distance between your public representatives and the citizens. But is that really all that is contributing to this service delivery protest? Or there are other matters, for instance, of real maybe or government not being in a position to deliver the services realistically in terms of the expectations of the people. But also the relationship, I think that you have mentioned, or someone has mentioned, between the other spheres of government in terms of support to local government. Is it sufficient? The constitution enjoins
those other tiers of government to give support to local government. Is that support sufficient? The crime. Yes, fighting crime. Why picking on Western Cape, not Eastern Cape or Gauteng? Or what? I mean, some people, I know that, I don't know which one is has more crime than between Gauteng and the Western Cape or which one. But I just want to understand and perhaps some lessons really that led you to choose that. But that's the last thing, Madam Shisan, is we got the bones. They're not very dry, you know. When can you get the meat? I know that there was not enough time. I'm sure you had problems of the time, perhaps, I mean, not having sufficient time to prepare for us of some more documents. Is it possible that we can get some more information on that, on the issues that you have raised? Thank you. But I want to make a suggestion, you know, just to say, one, if you could just respond to some points that you think that are salient points in terms of the questions that we have raised, and then we get other responses when, in writing. But I saw the CEO nodding when Mr. Sartre was saying we really have to invite you again. Our program is so tight. Normally Monday is not a working day in Parliament, but the next Monday will be working. I'll ask members if we can get another Monday so that where we're not going to have a lot of input, but just to be able to engage with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. One can be tempted to begin to answer some of the questions, but I'm sure it will elicit another question because these are issues that really require in-depth, you know, discussions. So what I'm going to suggest, Chairperson, is that we take your suggestion of actually coming in another day when we can be able to address some of the issues, and also respond to some of these things in writing, you know, start putting together a document that captures some of the key questions that you have asked and be able to provide with some of the evidence for some of these issues. I think we might serve you better that way than to try to give a soundbite on any of the issues that you have raised, if it's okay with you.
Now, I think that we are agreeable to that suggestion, but maybe what we would need to do, we can't finalize now, is to communicate with you in terms of how soon can we get together to address these issues. And I think that we're grateful that tomorrow, for instance, we're dealing with education and health. And now it would have been very nice to go into some more details. But I agree with the suggestion that maybe the way you have suggested, and I have a suggestion, a day to request from the members. I know there are days that are sacrosanct as far as the members are concerned. I can see the eyes, but I want to ask for those days from the members when you're not here, but it should be soon.
let's say then you can just make your closing remarks if there's something.
The last week that we sitting that we have, what I think from the 14th that Monday to round about or the 15th to the 20th, we've got no plenaries whatsoever. I don't think we'll have caucuses. We can sit in the morning and in the afternoon. So I don't mind that because I've got to be here in any case for the committee meeting. So let's use that time when we don't have plenaries in the morning and in the afternoon.
Let me are in your hands, SPO.
Let me say thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to come in and share ideas with you. I just want to say on an overall issue of the budget increase that we are raising, given the current economic situation, what we would like to say is that the prioritization hasn't taken place in the budget. Everything is seen to be very important if one looks at, you know, the appropriations. And what would appeal to you is to work on the budget in such a way that it reflects the priorities that have been identified. So we are not saying that we should go and tax people more now in order to be able to do that, but we're saying within the envelope that is available, let that be reflected in, you know, the budget that has been sent. And want to say to you that we consider this to be our responsibility in terms of the legislation to actually help in terms of reviewing policies, monitoring and implementation of things to look at that from a scientific point of view. And we stand ready to support you. And we stand ready to prioritize you. Given everything else that we have, we consider it really important to the nation that HSRC should be able to assist you in this direction. And thank you so much for all your questions.
Well, I think your last remark is music in our ears. we would also like to extend our gratitude for your understanding. But just to say, in the past, we have met in this way. I would really like to, in the interest of doing things differently, work with you and see if it will be possible in future, for instance, with the expert that you have. If we're dealing with education, we ensure that someone who deals with education can sit with us there. And someone who deals with health and so forth and so forth. So that sometimes even these inputs are not done in their absence. But not now, but we think that going forward, those are kind of things that would really help, would assist us as members. I know last year, today, there was this other information that you were giving, or at the beginning of the year. When we met that time with the joint committee, there were other extensive, what you call, inputs that you gave, especially on food security, agriculture, around those issues. But I think that would really like to engage departments. We don't know if perhaps they are, it can change. It can help, I mean, their approach as well. Because those people have been there. You can say, now let us do things differently. But the people who have been there for some time, there's no inkling of doing that. I don't know. I think that there are two issues then that we have requested. One, that if we could get answers in writing, but it doesn't take away the fact that we would really like to spend more time with you, and then we'll give you a date. I think members would like to do that now, but I don't think that we should do that now and come back to you. I don't know, maybe if possible, today is the 29th, no? And next week, Thursday, will be the Sorry? 5 November. Now, let's say by the 4th, by Wednesday. So would it be possible to get the responses? Okay. Now, thank you very much.
Okay.
Once more, we have been honored to have you. But I know you are okay then. FSC, our apologies. But I know you're always businesslike. Commissioner, the commissioners, and the team. you know, some of the questions that were raised, especially the one around the infrastructure, you know, that I would really like you, when you do your input, to respond to some of the questions. But also generally to say, here is the MTBBS. What's your take about it? You have made recommendations beginning of the year. What do you think of it? Thank you very much. And you know, if you're the last person, sometimes there's a tendency of being restricted. No? How much time do you need? 20 minutes?
Chair, I think we'll lose one of our members, Commissioner Tanya.
If we were in Gauteng, we wouldn't lose
because we're in the Western Cape.
No. but we can actually finish it.
Yeah. When does he want to leave? Right away?
No, quarter to. But I think
at least you will have done your input by then.
This one case even more big. Like.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
No, thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah. I think the way we're going to present, I'll just make a general introduction, and then Commissioner Tanya will talk on the national priorities. And then Commissioner Bongani Kumalo will address issues of provincial and local government. We are supported by Vincent McKinta, he's from the Secretariat, and on the other side, Andrew Exkin, he's with the office here. So, yes. Chair, as usual, of course, we do come here in terms of the FFC Act. And then in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Bill, we are here in that light before your committee, Chair. Now, what we are going to be highlighting here are just key issues that come out of the MTBPS, which we believe merit consideration by your committee. And secondly, we are going to talk a bit on specific references that are made in the budget that have to do with our recommendations. Our approach, basically, is recognizing that this budget, which will be drawn, of course, this is the framework for the budget when it comes later, but this will be drawn in the context of, you know, global economic crisis. That I think that's what we take. The point raised notwithstanding, but in fact, I think one of the people from the HRC said that this is an efficiency budget and I think she hit the nail on the head there, because what the minister is saying is that we shouldn't look for more money. We should look for efficiencies in the system. There is a lot of wastage in the system and so forth, you know. Then I think the other point that they raised, which is fairly relevant, is issues of mechanisms, you know. So if we say we are going to save, how are we going to save? If we say we are going to look for more resources, how are we going to do those? Those are, I think, some issues that the Treasury probably will have to come forward and say, these are the mechanisms and so forth, you know. I think another point we perhaps want to keep in mind is the Treasury is also saying what they are putting forward in this budget are proposals. It is how they think we can move forward, which means that we can still have an impact in terms of the way forward. And then, Chair, of course, the Treasury does project reductions in revenues going forward and so forth, hence the issue of savings and so forth. Then the issue that the Chair raises, we do realize and want to say yes, the Treasury realizes that one of perhaps the quick fixes is perhaps doing the infrastructure route, going the infrastructure route. But elsewhere in our recommendations also, we talk about the need to have a maintenance budget. And those are some of the issues we look at. But I think I'll pass on to my colleague, Tanya, and then eventually to the
Pastor.
Yeah, I'll switch you off. The water?
No, she's got to switch on.
Sorry, thank you.
Thanks for the technical assistance on the technology. The committee should be relatively familiar with the priorities, so I won't go over them. I think that the HSRC did an excellent job. But just to notice that while the priorities have been consistent, it's the fiscal environment, as Dr. Sitai has described it, that has changed. And so making the attainment of those priorities so much more difficult. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Just a quick sketch of the division of nationally collected revenues among the three spheres of government. Members should be familiar with this. What we see is that the national proportion of this revenue pool continues to decline steadily over the MTF period, whereas the subnational governments, provincial and local government, also increase steadily as national decreases. Moving on from there, we look at some of the assumptions underpinning the MTBPS. Remember, the MTBPS looks over a three-year period. When we look into the future, we always have to make assumptions, and the validity and credibility of those assumptions are important to the credibility of the overall spending projections. We agree with the fiscal easing proposed in the 2009 MTBPS, given the magnitude of recession. Like many other countries around the world who are similarly affected, it is appropriate for us to ease our fiscal stance somewhat. We note that the substantially bigger borrowing requirement is linked to large infrastructural investment projects that would be key for long-term growth and well-being of future generations, for example, ESCOM and Transnet. Okay, just the caveat here is that we would like to see those budgets, those projects staying within budgets and those large infrastructure projects implemented in a way that results in value for money. But overall, this meets with our approval. We've also done some of our own modeling, macroeconomic modeling, about what economic aggregates are likely to be in future. And the Commission's own modeling forecast raises the possibility that the anticipated recovery in industrial economies may not come as early as predicted. This means that the recession may take longer than expected and things may be worse before they get better. So the point that we're trying to make is that South Africa, as a small open economy, is heavily influenced by international markets. And if international markets are sluggish to recover, that recovery might take longer for it to filter down to the South African economy. And this means some degree of fiscal risk for us because of the timing delay, especially given that budgets are rigid downwards. In other words, it's easy to increase budgets, but it's not easy to decrease budgets if revenues lag because of the business cycle not picking up as anticipated. Okay, moving on to the next slide. The Commission is concerned over the unanticipated wage bill. There should be a deliberate attempt to synchronize the centralized bargaining process of the public sector with the budget process to reduce undue burden to subnational governments by decisions over which they have no direct control. There is a need for a collective responsibility to be taken if we are to strike a balance between the bargaining chamber's agreement and investments that create more jobs. The Commission recommends that the government should target specific employees and retrain those in position of the requisite skills in the employment so as to improve efficiency. And so these basically speak to two areas. One is that we've got a decentralized fiscal system, but our wage bargaining is centralized. So there is a need to strike a balance to mediate those tensions. Secondly, personnel expenditure is also very rigid, and it forms a big proportion of the overall budget. And given that the revenue situation is much more volatile, it becomes more imperative that the dynamics of the, on the personnel side be managed efficiently. Okay, moving on to the next slide. This slide is nothing new to members. It basically just shows the division of revenue in money terms between national, provincial, and local government as a percentage shares and also in terms of changes to the baseline. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Bongani Khumalo, to comment more on these numbers.
Okay, thank you, Tanya. Thank you, Chairperson, and members of the committee. I think what that slide shows basically is just shows the additional allocations over the MTF period. We see that of the 39 billion added to the provincial fiscal framework, 2.7 of that, or 8, becomes is transferred in the form of the equitable share over the MTF, and the balance is 7.1 billion becomes transferred in the form of conditional grants. So in terms of increases over the period, the conditional grants have increased in terms of their share by 28.3%. Now, I don't think that in its own right there is anything particularly wrong with that. But we still need to look at which of the conditional grants are actually showing increases. Is it because of new conditional grants that have been introduced, or otherwise? That's something that we will be engaging with the National Treasury on. I think in terms of the provincial fiscal framework itself, the Commission basically has noted the pressure on provincial budgets over the course of the year and going forward. That is going to be imposed by personnel demands. I mean, there are two areas where we have to deal with the implementation of the and rollout of the OSD, coupled with larger than expected agreements on collective wage bargaining that basically are not necessarily under the control of provincial government. Now, because these are entitlements, and these personnel costs are basically the key drivers in the key services that provinces basically deliver. That's your education and that's your health. Those are the key program areas. The pressure basically on provinces would be very high, and this might actually have implications for other areas of service delivery where provinces might slow down in preference of wage settlement. Obviously, the Commission notes that there has been a revision in the provincial equitable share baseline, which is in anticipation of further shifting of further education and training colleges from the provincial sphere to the local government sphere. In terms of principle going forward, the Commission's view is that whilst this is something that has been decided, there is still a constitutional process that must actually take place around shifting the function, which is currently assigned to provinces, and therefore a caution has to be exercised so that we don't actually disrupt service delivery and also provincial budgets in general in anticipation of this shift. I think the underlying principle here is that the process of the amount that will be shifted should be very transparent, and it should be very clearly specified. I think for some of the members here might recall the experience that we had when social security grants had to be shifted, and the chaos that actually ensued therein. And we should not repeat that experience that we had. So basically, we are basically calling for caution. Now, with respect to the local government fiscal framework, we note that the local government transfers increase around about 14%, 14.5% close on 15% over the MTEF period. The largest increase being in the equitable share, and that's about 16%, mainly to assist municipalities deal with anticipated electricity price increases. I think it is important here for us to refer the committee to recommendations that we tabled. I think it was in 2000 for the 2008 Division of Revenue. I think it was where we addressed the issue of possible 100%. Electricity price increases and what that would mean to the local government equitable share and the provision for free basic electricity. And I think it would be important that in considering these matters, the committee basically is aware of those recommendations. Conditional grants basically also grow at around 15%, mainly to expand the basic infrastructure services to households. Now, there are issues around the municipal infrastructure grants, the neighborhood development grant that sits with the National Treasury. Again, here, it is important from the Commission's point of view to draw the attention of the committee again to recommendations that were made in 2007 with respect to local with respect to the municipal infrastructure grant and the need to link the municipal infrastructure grant with the local government equitable share formula, because these two grants are allocated through a formula, and therefore we need to link that so that the rollout of municipal infrastructure through the MIG and the concomitant demands that it places on the equitable share for maintenance and operation of that infrastructure basically is recognized in the broader transfer system. So what we tend to be having at the moment is that municipalities roll out infrastructure and there's no money to operate and maintain that infrastructure, and you end up rolling at the same level. With respect to the neighborhood development grant, I think I would like to draw the attention of the committee to the submission that was made at the beginning of the year by the Commission on the Division of Revenue Bill for 2009, that there was expressed in that submission a need to review the performance of the neighborhood development grant. It's a grant that sits with the National Treasury, and municipalities can draw from it when they meet certain types of conditions. And it is important to review the performance of that grant, because it's one of those grants where spending tends to be very slow. And so when we see increases in those types of grants, we need to be cautious. basically what we're then saying with respect to the local government, the impact of the economic downturn on the local government side, is that whilst we have had a situation where a lot of municipalities, the big ones, the metros and the bigger cities, have been able to generally able to sustain themselves through own revenue generation, and are less dependent on transfers, the situation might actually change as a result of the downturn, where people lose jobs and fail to pay for the services that sustain these municipalities, and it might actually be important that we look at the transfer system, that it actually does take into consideration the knocks that might be experienced by local government in general, and especially those municipalities that are on the margin in terms of own revenue raising. They will increasingly depend on transfers, and that puts more pressure to your national fiscal framework. I think this is where I'm going to stop.
Thank you very much. We made a request to HSRC, and we, you know, in the past, now there's a recession hitting everyone. I don't know if you didn't have people representing you different components of FFC representing you during the hearings of different committees, but maybe now it's too late to make a request. But I think in future, would really like to look in those areas, especially in those areas of more interest to FFC. We're not asking for that now. You had your hand up, Honorable Swart. Okay, let's see.
Yes, just two questions. The one is on slide 4, page 4, where they make the statement the FFC is deliberate attempt to synchronize the centralized bargaining process of the public sector. Now, I know that you're a trade unionist chair, but, you know, whenever we increase wages and salaries, there is no consequential increase in productivity, and that is one of our major problems in South Africa. There is absolutely nothing put on the table by the trade unions to say, okay, you give me a 10% increase, I'll increase my productivity by 10%. So we're just paying more and getting less. This is unfortunately, I just make that statement so that they can look at it. But then we look at the viability, the conditional grants and the MIG grants and the equitable share grants to municipalities and to local authorities. We know, Chair, that a major proportion of these municipalities in South Africa don't use the grants for the purpose for which they were intended, because they use them for the normal running, day-to-day running of the municipality, because they haven't got other funds, and you know there's a huge debt outstanding. They don't collect the debts, and especially when we get to the smaller municipalities, and there's a lot of municipalities which are just not financially viable. And I would like to hear the FFC's view on you know, how one can perhaps tackle that and resolve that, because it's a serious problem with the state. I mean, you know, the government's paying this money for equitable share and MIG, but they're not getting, it's not being spent in the area, as you say, yeah, quite rightly, not being spent in the area where it should be spent. So there is no consequential investment in infrastructure, particularly with the MIG grant, which could create jobs and could, you know, could improve the infrastructure. Thank you, Chair.
We should also direct the other part of that question to us as to how much oversight are we doing. You have your hand up.
Just a small question, Doctor, about the borrowing. I think there was an issue about the borrowing for what the commissioner called the route for infrastructure development and lack of the maintenance. The question I want to ask is, relatively ill-informed question. Speaking about the borrowing.
There's nothing like that.
Speaking about the borrowing to the degree of 40%, 41% of the GDP at the outer year. What's your comment on that particular issue in terms of infrastructure development as a way to cushion the economic downturn? But the outer year, the 41% degree of borrowing, what's your comment on it? Given the pressure of the payback, I just want to hear your comment on that issue. That issue, what do you say? Because sometimes there is always this difficult balance between, and I think the minister was walking a tightrope on this issue, this balance issue. But it's a balance insofar as the projection is concerned. In real life, I just want to know your view in terms of projection in your real life. The 41% as a public debt, at what level does it begin to raise a red light flickering in terms of the affordability? Because in the long term, if anything goes not as planned, and you then have this burden that you have to pay back to service the debt as compared to the service delivery that you're speaking about. So that's a balance that you're talking about. I mean, we had a situation like this in 1994-95. So this issue about Kaduna Diva, the belt tightening process. But it was a different approach in terms of the public debt vis-a-vis the management of the current debt. So I just want to hear your comment there. It is a relatively ill-informed question. I mean, I don't understand this issue of economics.
Thank you, Chairperson. While dealing with this issue of local government, I would like to understand the role of the Development Bank and that of SALGA, so that issues become clearer when I at least look at the spending and performance of local municipalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Any comments? I want comments on slide 4. On bullet 3, slide 4, bullet 3, improving the quality of education and skills development, and then 5, rolling out of comprehensive rural development strategy. After what I hear tonight from the HSRC, it looks that we have some problems there. So I just want to hear what is the comments of the Commission in this regard. That's about education and rural development strategy for the medium-term spending priorities.
Thank you, Chairperson. This question might be irrelevant, but I'll ask it nevertheless. What's your take? There are those departments that keep shifting funds that for quite a number of times, and there are those programs also that are not as fast lane as others. And if then Treasury could recall those funds for fast lane programs, I don't know how best to put it, but that's it.
I don't know if the last question was understood. You'd like to attempt it? We'd like to have it rephrased. I think I also figure out difficulty.
Thank you. What I'm saying is we are aware that there are some departments that are not having, there are some departments whose programs are not as urgent. Some of their programs are not as urgent as the urgency of the priority programs. Yeah. But before coming to rollovers, there are programs that are not using their funds as fast as is possible. So it takes time for them to use those funds. Plus also, the rollovers, the shiftings, that would help if all that could be taken back to assist in the priority program. Once you're taking that one, I don't know whether it's better for you.
That's from my side on slide 5. The shares, how accurate are these what you call the shares? National 50%. Is that just at face value, or you taken into account the question of grant and what? I just want to understand, because the Minister of Finance yesterday, we were all there. His, what you call a sharing, was different from yours. Because we were saying local government speak about 16%. You know? That's right. So.
That is for only for the additional 78 billion rand, which they, you know, which they're going to get simple priority attention, priority area.
No, it's fine. I do hear that, but my question still stands. Because our understanding is that most of the expenditure is done. Implementation is done at a provincial level. That's why I'm just asking this question in local government. I don't know what were the what you call assumptions here. Yeah. I think that is the only question so far. I'm sorry. I missed you. I'm sorry, Comrade. You had your hand up. Comrade Tolle.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know, I heard these people when they were presenting, they mentioned something about the powers of the provinces to decide as they wish about their allocation. So what is it that you can advise? Maybe in the last 5 years, what was the tendencies in provinces and local government in actually diverting conditional grants into something else? Is this thing only in provinces, or it also happened in local government? And if yes, how far has it actually dislodged the strategic planning of this spheres of government? Thank you.
Answer.
Let me see now. Maybe I should ask you to take the first bite.
Let me just do the things in the way in which I have I have listed them. If I miss something, you remind me. The first one that I want to respond to is the one that that deals with the centralized bargaining processes. Yes, sir?
I'm sorry. That's your last remark was the experience of moving a social grant to this now. But you didn't come with the advice. You came with the question. What would you think? How would you think that they should be dealing with this particular question? Yes. And perhaps the other question that I mean, not necessarily what to call it. Is the question, is the consequences of this wage, what you call it, settlement, which everyone agrees. I mean, when you look at the MTBS, it looks like each and every department now is saying they are unintended. To the inflation, mine is different from my friend. I'm just thinking about the relationship between this wage settlement and the inflation. Thanks.
Yeah, no, I will try, but let me just deal with it in one go. The reason why we're saying you need to synchronize this is that these agreements tend to happen after provinces have been given an indicative amount of what to budget for in terms of personnel increases. Now, I would say the OSD issue is a different issue altogether. It's just probably there were mistakes. Let's say there were mistakes with the way in which it was first rolled out, and so the staggering, the effects of that staggering, the unfortunate outcome of basically becoming imperatives in a situation where we find ourselves in a recession. So that's understandable. But generally, wage agreements are centralized, and therefore it becomes problematic for provinces when agreements are reached that are actually higher than the indicative amount that provinces would have planned their budgets on. So we would like to see some form of synchronization in that respect in terms of that process. Now, how that links with inflation, I would not say that there is a direct link with agreements and inflation. Now, speaking strictly as an economist, not as a commissioner of the FFC, or as somebody who thinks about living wages and all of those things, I'm just saying that there's no direct link between the wage agreements and inflation rates, because the one basically when people ask for wage increases, they base it also. The agreements are based on what expectations about inflation are going to be. So you rarely get a situation where agreements are reached that are actually above the expectations on inflation. In fact, it's rare that you get agreements that are way above the inflation rate. So those are issues that relationships are not very easy to actually tie down. So I wouldn't say that. I think for the purposes of this, it's just the need to streamline those things. With respect to the borrowing issue for infrastructure and looking at the outer year targets of 41% as it were, projection of 41%. I think what is important in any situation, let me just say that in terms of targets for borrowing as a percentage of government budgets, in most countries, there's quite a number of developed countries that are at 60%. It's really about whether or not your economy is resilient enough to sustain your debt service requirements. That's what you need to get right. Now, for a developing country like ours, where I think let's look at the period that you referred to, around about 1996, early 94, 96. the debt service, when the debt service was very high. There were issues because always debt must be associated with the reasons for that debt. So there were issues about inherited debt and the moral around that and all of those kinds of things come into play. Because it's really a decision to borrow must be looked at as a decision to postpone tax increases. So you make a choice between whether you borrow to, you borrow today and postpone tax payment, which means you shift the payment of tax to your future generations, or you increase taxes today and reduce borrowing and thereby reduce your debt service ratio. And so we have had a good period where our debt service ratio has been on the decline. We've been reducing our debt. And also another good thing about it was that a significant proportion of that debt was basically domestic debt. So you're basically borrowing from, you're borrowing internally and you're paying back internally. Hopefully, the investment basically is happening internally to those people from whom you borrowed, and that can justify those types of levels of debt. But now I think what is key here in respect of our budget over the next 3 years, over the medium term, is the pressures that we have on the social security side, ensuring that we cushion people from the impacts of the economic downturn, plus the pressures on personnel budgets that we have to deal with, measured against how much of the borrowing we actually spend on productive infrastructure, is going to be the key issue. Now, so far what we see here is that a significant proportion of this borrowing is really to finance infrastructure projects. So one can basically live with that, and the fortunate thing is that we're still reaping the benefits of the surpluses that we had over the past 2 years or so. We're still reaping the benefits of not having chosen to spend very quickly those surpluses on useless kinds of investment. So what Commissioner Ajam was referring to here was that we need to make sure that the borrowing, basically, firstly, when we borrow for those infrastructure projects, we make sure that those institutions basically stay within the budget, and so that borrowing basically does not actually result in increased borrowing needs because they are running outside of the budget and chasing the wrong project. So long as the benefits can be tied to future generations of investment in infrastructure, one can justify why we need to shift the tax burden to them rather than carry it in this particular year. So, Honourable Member, what I'm really saying is that so long as this borrowing is not eaten today but invested for our future generations, it can be justified that we end up with that. But obviously there's that balance that you must strike, which basically is, to what extent does this borrowing stifle your private sector borrowing? Because, again, if the government goes into the market, it's competing with the private sector, and generally jobs are generated more in the private sector than in the... So you find a balance where you stop. You might have to be crowding out the private sector, and you've got to be careful about that. Let me link this now with the role of the DBSA. I don't know, there's a mention with SALG. I think the DBSA gets an injection to recapitalize from the fiscus over the period. Now, one thing that we need to think about is what's the role of the DBSA, and I think for some of us, again, might recall when we were dealing with the municipal borrowing framework under the development of the Municipal Finance Management Act, we did raise an issue for the role of the DBSA in assisting the poor or low-capacity municipalities to be able to play in the financial market, to be able to borrow, especially for infrastructure projects. So it's about increasing, using your development finance institutions to ensure that they empower your less capacitated or credit-worthy municipality to be able to play in the market. Now, what was happening at that stage was that the DBSA was probably the biggest lender to municipalities, and I think it still is. But the focus is on the bigger municipalities. So it basically pushes out other players, your private sector players who could actually be playing in that market, get pushed out by the DBSA because they can provide probably more competitive loans to those big municipalities compared to the private sector. And so the concentration of the lending basically is on the bigger, more capacitated municipalities. What also needs to be taken into account here is that there's money that DBSA gets through Cienza Manja, which is meant to assist municipalities build certain capacity. And that it does not flow through your division of revenue bill. So it's very difficult to assess what their role has been, for example, through that Cienza Manja project. So they will basically come and tell you how successful it is, but that's them that have actually assessed that. So I think it's important that we basically relook at tying these kinds of injections to the DBSA to certain expectations that the DBSA can be held against by the system. With respect to education, rural development, and what our view are against what the HSRC said, I think the HSRC said quite a lot of things around these matters. In fact, I was very happy to hear the chairperson suggesting that maybe it would be nice to tie them with the relevant departments. I had shared a note with one of my colleagues here that it's not very easy to engage with a discussion like that when the key players are not there, because some of the things that come up basically are not new things. Some of the issues that come up around, for example, the sufficiency of budgets are not new things, and I suspect that if one subjects them to the test, you might find that we are not speaking about the same thing. I'll give you an example around the ECD. So for example, they spoke about grade R and access to grade R. It's not an issue of the budget, because the allocation for education is very clear when it comes to those issues. You look at the number of that age that qualify, that age cohort in the whole country. You also look at how many of them are enrolled, and you find that you're looking at 98%, in some cases over 100% gross enrollment ratio, so which means you've got more people that are enrolled than you have people actually sitting in the classroom. So these are things that need to be interrogated a little bit more. They are not really issues around the budget. I don't think so. Rural development issues, I think it's an important point that was raised, that now we have a strategy. We have a strategic plan. The issue is, how do we build that into the financing framework, because the current fiscal transfer system does not have anything to do with agriculture or rural development as a component. You made reference to grants like CASP, for example. Those are nothing in terms of what the need basically is for these kinds of programs. And so an overall review of the transfer system is actually required before people can start making judgments about, you know, the success of pilot projects. It's not the first time that pilot projects around this have been done. There's a lot of them that were done in the Northern Cape, around chickens, around all sorts of things that have collapsed. So it's important that a comprehensive strategy around that is then developed, and then we deal with the financing arrangements once that is in place. The issue around provincial powers deciding willy-nilly about how to spend money, and I think it's important to distinguish between conditional grants and the equitable share. I think where you can have those kinds of decisions, where you have that flexibility as a province to take those kinds of decisions, is only with your equitable share. With conditional grants, if anything like that is happening, then the national department is not doing its job, because the conditional grants belong to the national department, and therefore there are systems to ensure. So I would probably say some municipalities and provinces are discouraged to take some grants because of the conditions associated with those grants. So that's, which is a different kind of an issue. With the equitable share, I think there's very little that one can do except moral suasion, basically, to say these are the priorities, please can you take them into consideration. I think we see quite a lot of frustration by national departments when it comes to these kinds of priorities and how they get reflected in provincial and municipal budgets. So that's an issue that needs to be taken into consideration. Coming back to your question, Chair, around the shifting of the FET function from basic to higher education, I think the important thing that I wanted to raise here is that in the current provincial equitable share formula, we don't have anything to indicate what the demand for FET, and I would include the adult basic education and training, and also inclusive education, which used to be education for learners with special needs. You don't have anything to basically tell you that this is the demand countrywide. And therefore, when we deal with the provincial equitable share, we ring-fence some money because we think that the uncertainty around the shifting of this function might result in some gaming from provinces. They're not putting more money into this kind of a program because they know it's going to go away. This is an issue around incentives that uncertainty obviously does generate, and they are unintended, but they do happen. Now, what we are asking for is for the National Treasury to basically give us a clear, transparent process of how they arrive at the amount that must then be, let's say, in the intervening period, be earmarked, as it were, out of the equitable share, to say this is now earmarked for FET, and we're protecting the program. What happened, let you recall, I think you were in that process, what happened with the social security grants was that we had an indicative amount of 18% on the provincial equitable share. I'm talking about the total pool. 18% of that was basically earmarked for social development, which included social security grants and welfare services. Now, at the same time, the expenditure patterns for provinces indicated that, on average, provinces were spending around about 32%. And now when you then say you are moving this function, how much money are you going to take away from the pool? Do you take away 18% or do you take away the actual amount of 32% that is being spent? Now, if you take 32%, you're basically allowing for those programs that had been prejudiced as a result of the demands on those cash transfers to basically be, you continue with that. So here, basically, what we're saying is like, we need to get an understanding of how one basically is going to arrive at the amount that you take out and say this is for FET. It might because provinces spend differently on these programs, and what might be good for Gauteng might not be good for Northern Cape, for example, when you take it out, but you're taking it out from the pool. So that's what I wanted to raise. I don't want to tell you what our thinking is at this point in time. We still must have some discussions with the National Treasury Chair. We will come back with our own proposals once we have seen what they want to do.
Yeah.
If I missed some of the questions,
No. No, it's not that you missed. I just want to highlight maybe one or two points. In line with what Bongani has just
given. I just want to revisit the issue of borrowing. To say that I think the minister has been saying that we can afford this borrowing now because we have had a surplus in the past, so we are sort of just rolling it forward. So we can afford that. However, the danger I think that, Bogani is raising here is that it depends now on where you borrow that money from. If you borrow the money internally, in the internal market, denominated in rands, you know, it's not that much of a danger because you can always refinance it through taxes. Problem is if you borrow in dollars, then you have to service that debt via export. So you need to export. Then you begin now to put competition, for your exports, for your hard-earned dollar and so forth. So I think that is where maybe a better clarification would have to come from the Treasury to say, fine, we'll borrow, we understand, but where are you going to borrow from? Will it just be a debt denominated in rands or denominated in dollars? So the one in rands is okay. We can, it's okay. We can live with it. But the one in dollars, then the red light, going forward, right? Then on the issue of infrastructure as well, I think that actually also needs to be unpacked, because if we just say we'll put money in infrastructure, the objective there might just be to say infrastructure will create jobs. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is that infrastructure should be self-financing. It should pay for itself in the future. So, for example, you may improve roads and then you put a toll gate. Then in the long run, 20 years, maybe you'll get your money back. But at the moment, most of our infrastructure, I think, is geared towards the poor. You know, we do infrastructure to the poor, which means actually it's the money we are giving away. You know, so if that is the case, it then means that we have to keep going back to the taxes, in order to finance this infrastructure. So that is a bit of a dilemma that we are in. So it might mean that we need to balance and say, out of this so many billions in infrastructure, so much will go to the poor, and then so much will go to where it will generate money, so that there's that cross-subsidization, so to speak, that will be very, very important. And then I think, the issue of the wage rate, I mean, yes, I agree very much actually with Bongani that synchronization is needed. It's very important. But I think we also have to be aware that I think about what? In this MTF, they're going to add about what? 13 billion, right? To the wage bill. About 13 billion to the wage bill. And that 13 billion is actually going to pay for government people. And government people don't produce goods. So that is going to be inflationary. It's going to be inflationary. And when you add other things like the multiplier effect and all the techniques of economics, it's fairly serious, actually. Yeah, right. But it is a dilemma because, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure when you're going to meet you again. But like I was saying, that we would really like to adopt the same approach, especially when we're dealing with some of the areas that we know that you have made your recommendations on. Especially, maybe it may not be now with you, especially come your recommendations in May or sometime. I'm sure we would like to engage with departments with you present there. Because sometimes some of the recommendations are taken up by government, others they need government normally say they need to be worked on some more closely,
Sometimes you never know. But we would like to
you know, this argument that money spent on the public service for salaries does not produce, you see, does not produce what? Doesn't it produce a better life? And therefore, actually, in the long run, may result in us spending less on things like social grants and welfare. Thank you.
You know, when we close, sometimes we close because I would really like you, I would like you, Rita, to give me this question in the passages. You know, I agree with the question, but I mean, clearly, as they were responding, there were more questions. I'm so with everyone. There's somewhere we need to engage, but in the interest of time, we thought that we should not do that. But we would like to thank you. You know, always with FSC, we always bank on your support. And I think that moving forward, we would really like to engage more with you on certain aspects that we'd really like to, where we need your help. I think that we will want to talk about those. But thank you very much for coming in the evening and sacrificing your evening tonight. But I would like also to thank the members. I know that it's their work, but we have agreed with the members that we have very tight time frames. Sometimes we'll work until late, but we would not like to. Other committees work until 10 or so. We would like to avoid that where we can. Hence, I'm sure if we work on Monday, all of us will come on Monday. We do that. We'll avoid, we'll be able to cover a lot of areas. Thank you very much. And colleagues, I suppose that there is one for tomorrow. We're meeting at, we're here tomorrow at 9:30. It's education and health. I'm sure we'll engage with them. It's only two of them. Between half past 9 and half past 12. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, no, that's good.